This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with longtime PBS host Dennis Hoehly. What an amazing career he's had in 50 years of journalism. Some ups and downs on the personal side as well, and we'll talk with Dennis Hoehly about it all. Also, Jerry Walker, former assistant sports information director at LSU, he's going for his fifth Super Bowl ring this Sunday in New Orleans with the San Francisco 49ers, who are facing the Baltimore Ravens. 49ers are a slight favorite in the game, and we'll talk with Jerry Walker about his career at LSU and where it took him to the Bay Area, where he has found tremendous success. And we'll visit with Ed Steimel at age 91, still out there, talking about his years as head of LABI and PAR. He was the man of business for decades in our state. Ed Steimel. All this, now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We're 5 days away from Super Bowl Sunday, number 47, this one in New Orleans. And it's at the Superdome where the San Francisco 49ers will face the Baltimore Ravens for the championship of the world. The 49ers have won five previous times, and the last time they played in New Orleans, they beat Denver 55-10. The 49ers are 3.5-point favorites over Baltimore. And with us is a man who's been affiliated with the 49ers off and on for over 30 years, former LSU Assistant Sports Information Director, Jerry Walker. He worked at Tigertown from 1972 to 1977, and he is going for his fifth Super Bowl ring with the 49ers, this time as the team archivist. Good morning to you, Jerry Walker.
Morning, Jim. That sounds good when you say that.
Well, five Super Bowl rings, if it goes well this Sunday, you're going to run out of fingers pretty soon.
No, I think when it comes to jewelry, there's no greediness, and I do have another hand, don't I?
This is true, but you started with the 49ers right before Joe Montana and Bill Walsh, and the Niners went crazy and started winning Super Bowls with regularity in the 1980s. But when you joined that franchise, Jerry, they weren't the best team in the NFC or the AFC. They were not a very good team at the time.
No, they were not. But I was really fortunate enough to be there with the building of the Bill Walsh, Joe Montana era. Those were good days.
I'm sure they were. Good for Jerry Walker as well. And you've stayed in the Bay Area. You left the 49ers for a while. That's why you missed one of their Super Bowl championships. But you've rejoined the team as the archivist. What does the team archivist do?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, it's one I think the boss has asked me from time to time, like, what the heck are you doing? Well, the 49ers are building a new stadium right across the street. Well, actually, almost right next door. It's like 20 yards away from the current year-round facility in Santa Clara, near Great America in Santa Clara. I don't know if anybody knows the geography out here, but building a new stadium, and part of the new stadium is going to be a Hall of Fame museum for the team. We have our own Hall of Fame. Everyone that's in the Canton Hall of Fame is in our Hall of Fame, and then we have a few others in our Hall of Fame, and we're going to put that winning tradition and winning heritage up on display for all our fans and else who wants to see it.
When will the new stadium open?
We're shooting for July 2014, and it seems like a long way away, but I don't know. The older I get, the faster it goes. I don't know about you. And then when you're doing a project like that, it just seems like, oh, my gosh, it's we're another month closer, or another 2 months closer.
July of 2014, and you go back to the Candlestick Park days when the 49ers were not so good, but the team is synonymous with the city. So how's it going to be in Santa Clara?
Well, we'll still be the San Francisco 49ers. And what's interesting is the 49ers season ticket list over the years, the city has a large chunk of people that own season tickets, but it's spread out pretty much around the Bay Area. So Santa Clara's got a ton of season ticket holders, and it's going to be a nice place to play. I'm going to miss Candlestick. Candlestick holds a lot of magic moments and a lot of tradition and a lot of good memories.
Mm-hmm. I remember Kezar Stadium.
Kezar. Well, part of our exhibit in the new Museum Hall of Fame, we're going to celebrate Kezar. We're going to celebrate Candlestick. And Kezar, you don't go this far back, but we're going to include people like Joe Perry and Hugh McElhaney and Y.A. Tittle. Well, Y.A. Tittle, of course you know that name.
I do indeed. I've interviewed him many times, and of course he lives not too far from you, Jerry.
Not far at all, but he's, you know, that's the guy that you can take out of Louisiana, but you can't take Louisiana out of him. Every time I see him, he smiles and says, LSU.
Well, Jerry Walker spent 5 years at LSU, and we'll talk with him about those days as well. But what about the 49ers? They were not considered to be one of the favorites to go to the Super Bowl this year. They're not only going, they're the favorite to win the game. And you've got an exciting quarterback, don't you?
Very exciting. It's kind of fun that we're favored, but that scares me too, because the Ravens are going to be, in my opinion, the most formidable team we played in a Super Bowl, counting the previous five, obviously, previous five that we've been in, obviously, and it scares me to have the odds makers saying we're the favorites. That's not all totally secure. But yeah, that exciting quarterback, Colin Kaepernick, what a season he's had. Well, what a half a season he's had. This will be his 10th game as a starting quarterback. 10 games, and he's in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, but Joe Montana in 1981 had not been starting that long, and he came out of nowhere as a pro. We knew him well as a college player at Notre Dame, but he was not a first-round draft pick, and he, of course, according to some, is perhaps the greatest quarterback who's ever played the game.
I would be one of those some. He's definitely the greatest quarterback that ever played the game, and thanks to him, that started my Super Bowl ring collection. But yeah, Cap, you can't compare the two. They're so completely different. But Cap is just really exciting. Really, just he's got nothing but an upside to his future, and I think he's exciting people around here enough that people are starting to look to the future like, well, what can we do next year if we had such a good year this year? It's like, that's kind of scary, because you know the NFL is.
Well, Kaepernick is an amazing physical specimen. Montana was not. This guy's what, about 6'6"?
Yeah, this kid is great size. His speed is amazing for the size he has. Some writer out here recently, Dan Brown maybe, put an article together and talked to some former Olympians and medalists and sprinters and people like that, and they said that he does everything mechanically right as a sprinter, and he should have been, instead of a college football player, he might have should have been on an Olympic team or at least the college track team, because he's got that kind of strength and speed and quickness.
Now, as noted, Montana played at Notre Dame. He led the Irish to the national title in 77, and then he led the 49ers to their first Super Bowl championship 4 years later. He was accustomed to pressure-packed situations. Is there any chance Kaepernick will crumble with the pressure this Sunday?
You know, there's always a chance, but what he's shown so far in his nine brief appearances is, you know, he's played again. He's played in New Orleans, in the Dome. He's played. He's beaten Tom Brady. He's beaten Aaron Rodgers. He's been in some pressure situations. Already, you know, not. I guess you could compare him to Joe's first year. Similar situations leading up to the Super Bowl 16 with Joe. So you don't know till the game is played and the ball's kicked off. But this kid has just been so cool under pressure. And every time he's made a mistake, like against Green Bay in the divisional playoff game, it was the first series anyway. He threw an interception for a touchdown. He came back from that mistake, that error, and that turnover, and led the team on a scoring drive. And it seems like in his brief season that he's had, every time he has made some kind of mistake, it seems like he comes back stronger. And the players really believe in him because of that.
Jerry Walker is our guest. He is the team archivist, former PR director of the San Francisco 49ers. He held that position from 81 to 93, has four Super Bowl rings, and he could get number five if things go as he hopes they will this Sunday at the Superdome against the Baltimore Ravens and Ray Lewis. They are a formidable team, and, of course, much of the attention this week is going to be on the coaches. You got brothers going against each other, Jim and John. Jim is the more celebrated of the two. John, as I noted last week, 10 years ago, he was a special teams coach at Indiana University under Jerry DiNardo. It's an amazing phenomenon to have these brothers against one another.
It really is. Well, obviously, it's the first time in NFL history that something like this has happened. The only thing close to it would be last year's Thanksgiving Day game when the two faced off. And they like to say that they coached the players who faced off, and don't take anything away from the players when you mention that the two brothers are facing each other. But yeah, it's they're sort of there's some differences there. Jim seems to be a little more aggressive, a little more volatile, maybe a little more cocky, where John seems to be the smoother, cooler. Maybe it's his Miami, Ohio background. Smoother, cooler, brainier guy.
Yeah, you went to Miami of Ohio, didn't you?
I did. I stuck that in there, didn't I?
Yeah, you did indeed. And there's only a year's difference between these two guys as well. So they apparently are very close in many ways and have chosen the same path in life, and that path has taken them to the Louisiana Superdome come Sunday. It should be an amazing spectacle as the Ravens face the 49ers. I did note that you spent 5 years at LSU from 72 to 77 as assistant SID, and your responsibilities included the basketball program under, at that time, an unknown coach named Dale Brown.
Dale Brown, one of the great people of the world. Dale took me under his wing. Well, Paul Manassa took me under his wing and taught me the business and tutored me and was my guiding star. But Dale used to take care of me, too. Dale, that was fun basketball. That was good sports back in those days with Dale and Charlie McClendon and Joe May and track. Those were fun days.
You were at LSU 5 years, and when you left, that was just about the time the basketball program took off.
Yeah. Yeah, why'd they wait? I don't understand. When I left, it took off.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, they went to they go to Dallas for a Final Four like 2 years after I left.
Well, they went to Philadelphia. And then went to Dallas. So they were in two Final Fours, but while they were going to Final Fours, you were going to Super Bowls and winning them.
Yeah, that's okay, huh? That worked.
Yeah, my friend and former roommate, Craig Kelly, who spent many years as the PR director of the Indianapolis Colts, he said his regret was that he never worked with you out in San Francisco.
Well, you know, we interviewed him. We flew Craig out for an interview, and at the same time flew in a guy from the San Diego Chargers, Rodney Knox. And we sat down. I love Craig. Great guy. Has done a great job with the Colts. I sort of leaned towards Craig Moore, and some guy named Bill Walsh said, well, let's go with a more experienced guy in this case. Craig was just coming out of school maybe at the time. So we went with Rodney Knox, and that worked out because Rodney turned out to be a superstar in the business.
Well, Craig did okay in Indianapolis, yeah. But it was Walsh's fault. Huh?
I blame Bill, yeah.
Yeah, Bill was quite a taskmaster, wasn't he? He was a great coach.
Outstanding coach. Every time I thought I knew what his next move would be on or off the field, he would surprise me. He was an unbelievable leader. He dealt with people in different ways than I see coaches today deal with people. Yeah, he was obviously a Hall of Fame coach, Hall of Fame person.
How has the game changed, Jerry, since you arrived in San Francisco 32 years ago?
Well, when I talk to guys like Keena Turner or Eric Wright or Ronnie Lott, and I mention this, they are quick to disagree with me, but it seems like the game has become more violent, and the defenses are just bigger, stronger, faster. I mean, that Ravens defense, that's just a scary outfit. So I know that we played good defense, and I know that we had some Hall of Famers on our defense, but it just seems that offensively, quarterbacks have become more mobile, obviously. And defenses have seemed to me to become more quicker, stronger, and more violent.
Well, Jerry Walker, you've seen a lot of football over the last three decades, and it should be an amazing game. I would think it'll be a close game Sunday.
I think it'll be very close. If it's not close, I hope it's not a lopsided against the Niners. But I think that both teams have potential to score. I mean, look at what the Ravens did against the Denver Broncos late in that game.
Well, good luck to you, Jerry Walker. It's good to hear your voice again.
Well, thank you very much. Always good to hear yours.
And we'll return with Dennis Holley on 89.3 WRKF after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're pleased to have a person who is synonymous with public broadcasting, Dennis Holy, with us. He's been in our living rooms and in our offices for many years, his voice, his face, and he is a prolific writer as well, and we will talk with him about a book that's certainly pertinent this week with the Super Bowl approaching in New Orleans. But good morning to you, Dennis Holy.
Hey, Jim, good to be with you and all of your nice people down there in Louisiana.
Well, as I stated, you've been around the block a few times in the world of media, about 50 years or so.
I guess so. It's amazing to think that. And chatting with somebody the other day saying, boy, the time just goes by so quickly, huh?
Yeah, and I think one of the best shows of all time as far as talk was your PBS late night show. That's one that I know you took great pride in, and it was something. It originated from Detroit, didn't it?
It was a Detroit show. Interesting, Jim, that you mentioned that. I certainly consider Late Night America one of the best runs that I've ever had. I did it for about 4 years, and it was interesting. It was kind of early to mid-'80s, I think 82 to 86, something like that. The thing that was kind of nifty as I look back at it, in those days it was ABC, CBS, NBC, and PBS. CNN was just coming onto the scene and hadn't cracked every single market. So it was kind of, we were in a real nice spot. We had about 150 stations, talk and telephones late at night, and just really great fun.
And you had people from all walks of life, famous people from other parts of the country who would show up and sit there on the set with you in Detroit, Michigan.
Yeah, it was really nice, and I was just thinking as he was saying that, you know, big stars, Anthony Quinn, Sammy Davis Jr., Lauren Bacall, controversial figures, Louis Farrakhan, one of the great interviews of all time, interviewees, I guess I should say, of all time, Muhammad Ali, Henry Ford II, the psychologist, the writer at the time, Leo Biscaglia. And we used to average, and looking back at it, used to average about 10 to 20 to 30,000 attempted phone calls a night.
My goodness.
Yeah, yeah. It was really amazing. And it kind of, I left to continue writing. I had one New York Times bestseller, I say with pride and humility at the same time, and I wanted to do some more writing, so I left the show voluntarily. But years later, Larry King came along and pretty much did what we had been doing on CNN that we had been doing back on PBS.
And I recall Larry King was once a guest of yours.
He was. And it's interesting you say that, Jim, because I remember he had had a couple of runs at television, and they were not successful at all. And when he came to do the show in Detroit, I remember him kind of looking around and saying, this is kind of nice. and it turned out to be exactly what he did later on.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember when I moved to Washington and we were doing early incarnations of the show that we do now, This Is America. We call it This Is America and the World now. But I remember him coming to do a show, and he was sitting in the makeup chair. I was in back of him, and he said, so I'm looking at him in the mirror, and he's shaking his head, and he's saying, I don't know how or why PBS just let you slip through their fingers. What he was saying was he thought that PBS was in a terrific position at that time to kind of go all talk and telephones and so on and so forth. That, of course, was not the PBS mission, but he was, and we became friends over the years. He's been in a couple of my books as well.
Well, and it was that time when you were hosting that program that you became a best-selling author, and one of your earlier books, The Courage to Change, Hope and Help for Alcoholics and Their Families, it included interviews with some famous people who opened up in a way to you that I don't think they would to many others.
Well, thank you for saying that, Jim. I suppose, I mean, obviously you're an accomplished interviewer. I can tell, you know, in the first 5 minutes of our conversation, preparation, willingness to listen, having goals, clear-cut goals in mind. I think there's also the factor of empathy, which obviously you show. And I was able to bring to the table in that book because I'm a recovering alcoholic myself. So so one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, that was golden right there. But the other thing that was so important with that book was it was the first book of its kind that made a lot of information about what I think really is an illness or a disease. It made the information available to the general public, whether it was personal stories with well-known recovering people, Jason Robards, Billy Carter, Pete Townsend of The Who, Grace Slick of Jefferson Starship, all of these people. But then interspersed with that was some solid advice from medical experts and people who ran treatment centers and so on and so forth. So the package was the right book at the right time, right place, and it had a little bit of that star glitz that nowadays we know is so important to anything.
You even had an interview with Wilbur Mills.
Wilbur Mills was, for the folks who might not know, headed up, I believe, the Appropriations Committee for the House, and was, you know, a major player in Washington. And at the same time, he was drinking himself into oblivion, as we all did. So I say that with a certain amount of whatever. He was dating a stripper by the name of Fanny Fox, who I guess it would have all stayed rather hush-hush unless one night she jumped out of his limousine at the tidal basin and I think maybe jumped in the water or something like that. And that, of course, exploded it in the press here in Washington. But he told a very interesting story of being invited to the White House to give Gerry Ford some of his wisdom and expertise on some major issue, and he doesn't remember being there at all. He didn't. He was in a blackout for the whole time.
Well, as I stated, you've been working consecutively in high places in journalism for about half a century, and yet many people would be totally oblivious to the fact that you've had a demon or two in your life, including alcoholism. How are you able to keep going?
Well, you know, when you're younger, and you're drinking, you're able to bounce back pretty quickly. And that's a really nifty question because it recalls to my mind, and I hadn't thought about this for a long time. I was I was very disciplined about when I was doing shows that were, let's say, Monday through Friday shows. Very disciplined about not drinking heavily during the week. So I don't think that I ever missed a show. I know that I never missed a show. I must say that at the end, and I say this with some humor, at the end, when I was doing a local talk show before Late Night America in Detroit, I convinced the management that it would be more efficient for the budget if we did all five shows on one day. And we did. We did. Which, as long as you held yourself together to be able to knock out five half hours in a day, then you were pretty well free to drink for the rest of the week.
We're visiting with Dennis Holy, and we'll talk with him about his book, The Chance of a Lifetime, an amazing Super Bowl story. But finally, on this topic, I recall that interview you did with Larry King probably 30 years ago, and he had written a book, Tell It to the King, in which he told about his own problems with gambling and how he hit bottom and almost went to jail, but came back. And you asked him the question. You said, did you ever think about ending your life? He said no. Did you ever think about taking your life?
I'll say yes and no at the same time. It's a powerful question you put on the table, Jim. What I did do one night when I was in New York, living in the penthouse and drinking myself into oblivion, I called a friend of mine and I said, would you come down? I just think I should get myself off the streets. And by that, I meant that I wanted to check into a hospital because I had done an awful lot of therapy, and I guess I was self-protective enough that I just said, you know, I never thought of, you know, pills or a gun or anything like that, but I knew that I was vulnerable to committing suicide. So I did in the end. It's a longer story than we have time for, but I did check myself into St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City in the psych ward, and I spent about 5 or 6 days there. I should say that for those folks who may be listening, for some of these horror stories that I'm telling and you're provoking in my mind, the good side about recovery on the other side is I say it's tough to quit drinking if you're an alcoholic, but once you get the hang of it, it's not difficult at all. And I've now not had a drink for 32 years, I guess it is. So, but, you know, you look better, you feel better, your relationships improve, you have a zest for life that you never had before, you have a spiritual dimension to your life. It was a second shot at life. There was no doubt about that. And I say all of the good things that have happened to me in my life and career and the opportunities I've had have opened up because of being able to, as they used to say in those days, put the cork in the bottle. Well, I didn't do it alone, I should say. I did not do it alone. And to try to do something like that alone, there's many, many ways that people can stop drinking or drugging if they're addicted to chemistry of any kind. But I think it's easier to do it with the support of other people.
Well, the title of the book that we're about to discuss, it may have a dual meaning, The Chance of a Lifetime. It's a book about football and about an amazing person, and the owner of the worst team in pro football decides to have a nationwide coach contest. What happens, Dennis Holy?
Well, you framed it beautifully because this contest that this crazy owner has gets 6.5 million entries, and it's won by, surprise, surprise, a kind of a mid-level auto executive out in Detroit who's not working at the time, and he knows very, very little about football. His son does play but in junior high, but he doesn't know much about football at all. But his wife, who sent his name into the contest as a joke, knows everything there is to know about football. She came up in a football family. Her father was a coach. Her two brothers played. She was at every single game. So they cut a deal, and the deal is that he'll be the front man, and she'll be behind the scenes, and she will guide him through the week of practice with this ragtag team that's set up in Boston, and she'll be up in the booth on the headset calling in the plays during the game. So the first part of the book is the week leading up to the big game, and the game becomes, you know, a national, an international story. So I will tell the folks that things go well. Let's put it that way. And when it says an amazing Super Bowl story, there is a march to the Super Bowl. There's no doubt about that.
The book is The Chance of a Lifetime, an amazing Super Bowl story from Dennis Holy. Now, this is Super Bowl 47.
Yep.
I was a kid, but I'm old enough to remember Super Bowl I in Los Angeles on January 15, 1967, and there were empty seats. The game has taken a life of its own. It's the biggest spectacle, perhaps, in the world.
It absolutely is, and when you think of the hoopla that goes in leading up to the Super Bowl, it's become an American ritual, iconic ritual, to be sure. Interestingly enough, we've watched since those early days the cost of a 30-second spot just go through the roof. Advertising agencies and sponsors are constructing television spots specifically for the Super Bowl. The halftime is just always, you know, the show is always a big deal. And, of course, in Washington, we had an amazing run with a young quarterback that became the darling of the NFL by the name of RG3, Robert Griffin III. Who got injured in a game against Baltimore and then continued to play, rightly or wrongly, and was hurt again at the end of the season. So in Washington, they got knocked out of contention, so we had to switch our allegiance from Washington to Baltimore.
which is tough to do for some people in Washington.
Well, absolutely, because the two cities are night and day, but separated by about a 50-minute drive. But the thinking that you have two, and I don't lay on this too much because I'm a Flacco fan and I hope he does well, the fact that the two brothers are coaching against each other makes it a magical Super Bowl as well.
Well, before we leave, tell us about This Is America with Dennis Holy. You're still very active in journalism.
Oh, absolutely. We thank you for that opportunity. The show we've evolved. It, as a matter of fact, a verb that President Obama made famous. We have evolved the mission of the show to This Is America and the World. We went through, and still, as all of your listeners know, a kind of an acrimonious time where Republicans and Democrats and progressives or liberals and conservatives just banging their heads. And my producer and I just sat in the office and said, if we have to do this every week, you know, let's find another show to do.
Well, Dennis Holy, an honor to share the microphone with you and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much, and I hope everyone down there enjoys the Super Bowl. Thank you, Jim, so much.
My pleasure. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and it is our pleasure at this time to talk with Ed Stimel, the founding executive director of the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry. He held that post for 15 years, and he was with the Public Affairs Research Council for 24 years, a native of Arkansas, born January 20th, 1922 in Running Lake, Arkansas. He is now 91 years old and has a lot of wisdom to share with us. Good morning to you, Ed Stimel.
Good morning.
As far as your career, you were head of the business organizations at times when the tension with labor was intense. There was violence on the streets. How do you remember those times now?
I remember very distinctly because the district attorney called me after we passed the right to work law, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, said some people are going to treat you just like that. They did the public protection director for us. They were going to, I guess, but they were kill me.
They were going to kill you.
Yeah.
Did you fear that your life was in danger?
Yeah. So he asked me if I wanted police protection? I said, yes. So the policeman came out there for about 2-3 nights.
Do you recall Jim Leslie, the man who was killed in 1976 when Right to Work passed?
Yeah, Right to Work was passed that day, finally, and he was killed that night.
And, of course, your adversary in those days was a gallant man named Victor Busey, who was
right.
the long-term president of the Louisiana AFL-CIO. You had an unusual relationship with him, didn't you?
Yes, we did. We had a good relationship, especially after we quit opposing each other in the legislature. But, no, he was a good man.
You say he was a good man. At the time that you were going tooth and nail fighting each other on various legislative fronts in the legislature, you saw each other in the hall. In those days, did you speak to each other, or was it a battle royal going on between the two?
Yes. We had to fight each other in the legislature. And thank goodness, I guess, I won more than he did.
Well, in those days, Louisiana's legislature was largely a Democratic legislature.
Yes.
Most members were Democrats, and the governors generally were Democrats until David Treen. How were you able to have success?
I guess the main reason was that we supported most of the legislators who got elected. We had a political action committee that contributed generously to legislators in their campaign. Our actual election had occurred the year before,
mm-hmm.
so we had most of ours was promises for the next election. But we were successful in bringing the legislators around. In fact, I remember lobbying one legislator, senator, for 5 hours. I finally got his support.
How did you do it?
I don't know. I listened mostly.
Listening sometimes is a powerful ingredient in negotiations.
Listening was still more important than talking.
Mm-hmm.
It is today.
So you left LABI in 1989, as hard as it is for us to believe. That's 24 years ago. Buddy Romer was the governor then. And in those times since, we've had several governors. We had the return of Edwin Edwards, and then we had Mike Foster and Kathleen Blanco and Bobby Jindal. What do you think about the current governor?
The current governor, I think he's, in many cases, doing a very good job. He's fair pro-education, which is my main concern.
Why do you think that he is doing a good job when others, of course, are taking aim at him right now?
What?
Others are not as charitable as you in their remarks right now, but you didn't hesitate one bit. You said he's doing a good job.
I'm not too happy with Jindal's tax proposal. I don't think many people are.
What is it that you don't like?
Well, I think a sales tax is very, very good if it has enough breaks for the poor people.
Mm-hmm.
But if it doesn't, then the poor people can't handle it.
One of the things that you fought for in your days as head of LABI was to do away with the prevailing wage law. Since then, you say you've had some misgivings about that. Why?
No, I really had no misgiving about the law. I had misgivings about how some of the plant heads were using it because they were not paying the proper wages. And I told them if they didn't do that, they would bring back unionism back. But they didn't listen.
Do you think they did listen or they did not?
Did not listen.
Did not listen. So the law that you led the fight to change hasn't necessarily done everything that you thought
no.
it would. Does that disappoint you?
It does disappoint me that plant managers did not pay comparable wages with even Houston. They were way below Chicago, New York, or any other, but they were not even comparable to the Houston, which is what they should have matched, but didn't.
We're visiting with Ed Steimel. He was head of the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry for 15 years. Prior to that, 24 years as head of the Public Affairs Research Council. Dan Juneau has been in charge of LABI, I guess, longer than you were. How do you think he's doing?
Doing fine.
The other day we had Foster.
I wish he hadn't lifted it up, that is, stop fighting gambling, because that was my main concern was to kill gambling and to save education.
You think gambling should be eradicated in Louisiana?
Absolutely. I think it ought to be eliminated.
Including the lottery?
Yes, because gambling doesn't hurt anybody but poor people.
But doesn't it, for the lottery, doesn't it help state coffers? It would be almost impossible to run the government without it now, wouldn't it? We count on that money.
Maybe a lottery. But
not riverboat gambling, not slot machines and those sorts of things. Casinos, that's not your deal.
No.
Well, the genie's out of the bottle.
What?
The genie's out of the bottle. How would we turn back from being so dependent upon
that?
Now, when you lived your life during the Great Depression, you were in rural Arkansas. I said you were born in Running Lake, Arkansas. How did a kid from one of the most rural regions of North America end up being so prominent on the stage?
I guess the answer to that is one thing, education. I taught school in the school where I was educated for first eight grades. I even had two of my sisters in my school the 2 years that I taught. I only taught 2 years and then retired because they weren't paying me enough. I knew that my friends from northeast Arkansas had gone to the north, were making as much money in a week as I was making in a month, so I decided to go up there.
How did you end up in Louisiana?
Well, I ended up in Louisiana because I went to Arkansas State College and got my degree in English and journalism, and then I was taking a course in Chamber of Commerce Management, and I had completed two courses, but I asked the president of the university of the college if I could take the third year before I took the job with him. He said yes, so I took the third year, went to Dallas and to my final 2 weeks of training, and while there, met Preston Coors, who had just been hired as the new manager of Baton Rouge Chamber of Commerce, and he was looking for an assistant manager, so he hired me in Dallas.
You've seen so many of your contemporaries die. You're 91 years old. You've lived a long life.
I will die too someday.
You will die, but probably not for a little while. And how is it when you see so many people who were your friends and foes, people like Victor Busey, who also lived a very long life? He died in 2011, and I think Victor was 92 years old, 1 year older than you are right now. When you see these people pass away, is it a bittersweet moment for you?
Yes, because I like Big Busey. He was a good person. I just differed with him on what he wanted.
Did you go to his funeral?
I wanted to, but I was out of town. But I wrote his wife after I got back.
Now, you've written your memoirs.
I started. I've written about 50 pages.
What do you want to convey to the people who have followed your life?
I don't know. Whatever people think.
Well, what is it, Ed Stimel, that you have learned along the way, particularly in Louisiana? And as I said, your life began in 1922.
My most important interest was education and later higher education. We were very much involved in passing the what's now called the AG Fund, but it was a settlement between the federal government and the Louisiana state government of $600 million. And I was working to try to capture all of that in a trust fund for education. Edwin Edwards wanted it all too. He finally settled for $100 million, and we got $500 million for education, which later was divided into two parts, half of it for higher education, half of it for elementary and secondary.
Do you recall, Ed, where you were when Pearl Harbor occurred?
Yes.
Where?
I was in a street on Government Street by Old Griffon's Drugstore driving.
That was an amazing time in the life of our country. What happened to you at that point?
I was going between my job in Michigan City, Indiana, where I was a spot welder in a factory that built folding chairs. And there I went to Walnut Ridge Air Force Base, worked there for about 2 years, and was transferred then to Fort Myers, Florida, worked for about 3 years, and became manager of the engine buildup department, even though I wasn't really a mechanic. But I started out as a mechanic, then an inspector, and then the manager of the engine buildup department. So we put engines on B-24s, later B-29s.
Now, in 1963, 50 years ago this November, President Kennedy was assassinated. Do you recall where you were when that happened?
I don't recall exactly where I was.
Okay.
But I remember it, and I was upset just like everybody was. was.
One of the notable achievements that you have had occurred after your tenure at LABI. You were at the LSU Engineering School as a fundraiser, raising millions of dollars for the university, and in particular the School of Engineering.
Yes. After I retired at 67, at the end of 1988, I went to LSU, stayed there for 17 and a half years, and we were successful in raising a lot of money from the trust fund that came from the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
Patents.
What do you think about the cuts to higher education today?
It's in bad shape. I notice that they're apparently going to increase tuition, or at least give authority to the state, the college president, to increase tuition. I think that's going to be necessary. Our tuition is low.
Well, the last 17 years, Ed Stimel has been accompanied in many venues by his dear friend, Pat Snow, who's a prominent member of this community. Pat, how did you and Ed meet?
A number of years ago on a Holy Thursday at St. Thomas More Gumbo Supper. And my husband had passed away a year before, and his wife had passed away a year before. I didn't know him, but I knew who he was because his picture was always in the paper. And here he comes with his tray and his bowl of gumbo, stumbling along because Mary is not there to tell him where they're going to sit.
Huh.
And I was sitting with some friends, and he kind of was so hesitant. And I said, would you like to join us? And so he did. And then a few months later, there was something else at St. Thomas More. And he saw me there. And when we went to sit down to eat, he followed me and sat near me. When it was time to leave, it was still daylight. It was 7 o'clock something. And he didn't know how to leave. It was like he was 14 again. And I said, Ed, I just live about a block and a half away. Would you like to come by my house for a cool one? And so we sat out by the pool and had a glass of wine, and that was the beginning of our seeing each other.
Now, you, I would say, are less conservative than he is. How does it work with your political views and his?
Well, we decided if Mary Madeline and James Carville could get along, we could get along. And we used to have some real good battle royals, because I love a good discussion, a hearty discussion. And we had quite a few, but that's mellowed through the years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know who's right.
Have you changed his mind?
On some things, actually.
What have you changed his mind about?
Oh, I wish you hadn't asked me that. I can't recall right now, but politically, I'd better not second guess something he's already said. I do remember politically something. We were at a party at the governor's mansion when Governor Blanco was governor, and he said, do you know why I like you as my governor? And she said, why? He said, because you're the only governor I could kiss. And he leaned over and kissed her on the cheek.
Ed Stimel, who was the best governor you worked with?
Kennan, I believe.
Bob Kennan?
Why Kennan? Well, He passed the kind of legislation I thought was good for the state, and unfortunately, the people didn't agree, and so they put Earlong back in after Kennan.
Yeah, you're going back a ways to Bob Kennan.
Kennan was 1952 to 56, I think.
Yeah, and so he's been out for almost 60 years, but you remember him well. Since then, most memorable governor?
Well, one of the most memorable was John McKithen. I fought with him a lot, but also agreed with him a lot. I thought he was one of the best in bringing industry to Louisiana of all the governors that we've ever had. Unfortunately, he didn't last to... He brought us the Code of Ethic, which later has been eroded a lot, but at any rate, I think he was a good governor. But his interest was to bring industry to the state. That was more than anything else. But he also, one time, he went after my job at one time, using Bill McDougal, who was formerly the head of civil service, but later worked for him. And so I made a speech. He wanted to pass the governor right to succeed himself. Up until then, only a governor could only serve one term.
Consecutively.
So I made a speech in New Orleans, Rotary Club, saying finally that we didn't think Louisiana was ready for the two term. Well, he called me immediately and said, you're trying to get my job, so I'm going to go after yours. So my wife was upstairs and listening on the phone, and she said, "Well, you son of a bitch, you can't go after my husband's job." So anyway, then I had lunch several times after that with John McKesson, but he never forgot what my wife called him.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, and congratulations on 91 fabulous years, and we look forward to many more from the remarkable Ed Steinman.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show, and tomorrow it'll be Bob Mann in the host chair as we visit with the LSU journalism professor and former aide to Governor Kathleen Blanco and U.S. Senators John Breaux, Russell Long, and Bennett Johnston. Bob Mann always does a good job, and we'll hear from him tomorrow. I'll be back on Thursday, and we'll have a redo with Jake Tapper, who was scheduled to be with us last week but has rescheduled for Thursday. The CNN and former ABC reporter Jake Tapper will be with us. Until next time, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.